Before we do anything else, the rules of Syracuse involved podcasting state, dictate even, that you shall start with follow. Did you ever, did we talk about that on the show? The shall versus will versus whatever. When I was doing government contracting, whenever we wrote requirements documents, you knew a requirement because it said, you know, the software shall do X, Y, or Z. If will is not enough, the software shall do X, Y, and Z. And that's how you knew.
Well, I guess that makes sense because will means like a prediction of what it will do, whereas shall is like a dictation of what it needs to do. But what,
I guess, yeah.
Can you not just substitute the word must for the word shall? Like, how do those differ?
Maybe.
You got to look at the internet RFCs, you know, those things, those big documents, right? I believe they have a formal definition of will, shall, and must and all that stuff. I don't know if it's the same as the ones that you had to deal with, Casey, but it's definitely a thing.
It probably was. This was when I was working at a big government contractor. We were doing stuff for the Navy, so it was all of that happy horse manure. But anyway, I digress.
So I just searched for must versus shall. The first result is a page on the FAA website, weirdly. But it basically, it says must and must not are words of obligation. Must imposes a legal obligation that something is mandatory, must not is prohibited, but apparently shall used to mean must, but these days shall is kind of understood now to mean may.
Oh, interesting.
And they advise that you go through and replace shall with must wherever you use shall to mean that, because must is unambiguous.
I put a link in the show notes to the IETF one, the RFC one. It's got must not, should not, may, required, recommended, optional. It makes more sense than the one you were just reading, but it is the place where programmers are most likely to come across these particular important words, because you'll be looking up something in some spec, like the HTTP spec or the TCP spec or something, and you'll run across one of these documents and it'll have these words in all caps, and this is what they mean.
I read the show notes several days ago as I was looking at something, and the very first item of follow-up, our show notes read as follows: John's cheese grater broke. And because I'm a turd, I saw this and just cackled in excitement because I was like, oh, man, it finally – oh, wait, this literally means a cheese grater, doesn't it? So, John, tell us about your 10-year-old computer that's still chugging along and your silly cheese grater that I have used once and got shamed for it, by the way. I'm assuming this is the same one. Tell me about your cheese grater.
It's a little learning curve for the cheese. Yeah, my computer's fine. We were talking about kitchen stuff last show, and I said I was like, my cheese grater was on its last legs, and I didn't know how many I had in reserve. It really was on its last legs, because between that show and now, it finally did. The last little bit of plastic that was holding the little flappy thing on broke, and it just came off. It's the same way they always fail. They fail, you know, like a crack starts forming, it just creeps its way up. I nursed this one for a really long time, being very careful with the cracked plastic, but eventually it was dead. So now I know how many I have left. I unboxed a new one, and I'm using that one now, and I have one in reserve. So I had two left before this one broke. Now I'm on my second to last one.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I think I gotta put a thing on the calendar. I guess recording this podcast is one way to do it, because I want to know how long do they last. Like, I don't really pay attention, but now I have a recorded version. So when this next one breaks, I'll be able to do the date math between now and then and know roughly how long these things last.
The real question that everyone wants to know is, did you purchase for $75 a replacement to your favorite spatula?
I did not. It was black only. I couldn't overcome that. And I don't think I would have gotten it. Like I said, unlike the cheese grater, the spatulas continue to function seemingly perfectly. Like, there is nothing wrong with them other than, you know, slight discoloration from, you know, food sticking to it. But other than that, like, I don't foresee them breaking in any way. So I don't need to have a giant supply. Unlike, for example, Apple Extended Keyboard 2s or whatever, you know, if you want to, like, if you're using something that's going to wear out, keyboards wear out, albeit slowly. These cheese graters wear out way too quickly. Spatulas, they just last forever, kind of like this Mac Pro.
They just slowly leach plastic into your food forever.
It's not leaching plastic. We established this.
I found the post on Instagram that I put up 289 weeks ago on December 21st of 2013, where I attempted to shred some mozzarella, which I'm sure I've butchered that pronunciation. I tried to be Italian. But anyway, I shredded some mozzarella, and John absolutely mercilessly shamed me for it. And so
this is a different cheese grater. This is the box grater. This was like pizza cheese.
geez, Casey, what are you doing?
Yeah, that's a totally different thing. Totally different. How would I break that thing? That one we still have. And again, unlike the cheese grater I'm talking about, I don't foresee it breaking. It's just a...
Wait, what cheese grater did I use for this then, if not a box grater?
A metal box grater.
Oh, so what are you talking about then?
I'm talking about the thing I use to grate Parmesan cheese, which I do frequently because it's a staple in the household. And it is an OXO...
Is that like a sword?
No, it's an OXO model they don't make anymore. Probably because it has a fatal flaw and it breaks after a couple of years. But it's so much better than the model they ship now. The model they ship now is like, I don't know, just Google for like OXO rotary cheese grater. You'll see the current model, and the current model is terrible. This old model was genius, other than the fact that it breaks eventually.
Oh, this is the thing that they bring around at like Olive Garden, isn't it?
No, not quite. I mean, are you looking at the current one? I mean, put a link in the chat.
This is one of the options, and this looks to me like what I would find at an Olive Garden.
Yeah, so that is the current model, and it is no good. Because if you grate a lot of cheese and you try using that, your hands will hurt. It is not good. You don't have good mechanical advantage, because as you squeeze that handle, the pressure on the part that is pressing down on the cheese is less than your hand. Like you're using a lever, but in reverse, right? It's like squeezing way down at the end. The force at the tip of that lever is less than you're squeezing down there. So it is a mechanical disadvantage. No good.
So, and what is yours? Can you link to yours?
I just put something in the chat. Is that the correct thing?
Yep. So that's mine. So that one, you can't really see in the picture, but so that's that cylinder, like it opens up along that hinge. Do you see the hinge thing there? It opens up along the hinge, and the thing that is, you know, it's got a very, very thin curved piece of plastic that sort of keeps the cheese in. So you open it up, and then you can slide the cheese down. Like the metal cylinder is going up and down. You slide the cheese down next to the metal cylinder, and you squeeze the cheese against the cylinder with your entire hand. Like you are directly pressing it against the cylinder, and then you rotate the thing. So you put one hand around the cylinder, and then the crank on top, you turn. It's still kind of difficult to do, but it is pretty much as good as you can get in terms of, I mean, there's no mechanical advantage to squeezing, but there's no mechanical disadvantage, and the turning thing is good. Inside it is a cylinder with very, very small, widely spaced holes to get a good, you know, Parmesan cheese grate going there.
So why couldn't you find like a reasonable facsimile of this? So for example, I put a $13 item in the chat room, which seems to me like it is roughly the same thing you're
totally
discussing.
Different. What are you talking about?
Why is it totally different? It's a vertical
thing. Look at this little knob. Look at this little plastic, uncomfortable knob. It has to be big, round, you know, grippy, OXO, rubberized. Like, that's the whole point of the thing. And I don't even know where the cheese goes in this thing or how the gripping would be. And, like, that big protrusion coming out of it, you can't grip it from multiple angles.
Look at the second picture. It shows exactly what happens.
Yeah, no, that's no good. Like, I don't understand what that big orange thing is sticking out there. Now you can't grip it. Like, you can't grip it from any angle because it's not a cylinder. It's a big protrusion thing. And also the holes. That's not the right... The metal cylinder, that's not the right shape for the grating. The holes in this thing are very small.
I just buy pre-grated Parmesan cheese, and it's awesome.
That is the most Marco answer I've ever heard.
Well, so here's the thing. Pre-grated costs even more money, first of all. But second of all, the whatever machine they have, like in Whole Foods that grates it for you, grates it too fine for my taste. Like, it's like tiny pieces of hair. It's too wispy. I want one step up from that. I like the texture the OXO makes. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, technically, when I'm saving the bodies of these things,
wait,
so
<what? laughs>
when they all die, in theory, I will have the raw materials to make some kind of Frankenstein cordless drill powered, you know, that's what I want, an electric one. I don't have to do this by hand at all. I like just an electric one. All I need is something that can turn with lots of torque, but not too quickly. And then I can just shove the cheese down into, right? So I might, you know, go all steampunk on this eventually, but
what is it? We have the technology, we can build it, something
like
that.
For the next, let's say, 3.5 to 6 years, I think I'm good on my, I'm assuming these last like maybe 3 years. Maybe I'm really wrong about that. Anyway, we'll find out.
Can you commission somebody to like custom mold you a replacement?
Yeah, like 3D print it. That you can do anything with a 3D printer.
Yeah, can you hire like a maker?
No. I mean, if I should show you this. Like I look at it, it's amazing how unrepairable it is, because it's a tiny, tiny flat piece of plastic connected. It's like glued in, and you can't fasten it any other way, because for the cheese grater to work, it has to close completely. Like, you have to be able to close that thing down completely for, like, the last little bit of cheese. You have to basically get that cylinder so that it is basically, the plastic is basically touching the metal thing. Otherwise, you end up with that part of cheese that you can never press against the grater, right? So it has to close completely, completely, which means that it has to be, like, a perfect, you know, it has to be just the little C-shaped thing with a flat plastic flap coming directly out of it. If you tried to attach it with any kind of glue or fastener or anything to strengthen it, it wouldn't close all the way. And now you've got basically a non-functional grater where you can never grate that last little bit of cheese. So it's not a good design. Like, they kind of messed up in what they, but what they replaced it with is worse. So I might just have to go and look on eBay and see if I can find some more of these.
I just did, and I didn't come up with anything in the first research. Yeah.
I think I bought like 5 or 6 back when I bought them, and maybe that wasn't enough.
You cornered the market.
Yeah. And none of them were $75. Let me tell you, they were all like, you know, $12 each.
I just can't wait for some listener of this show, either now or in like 4 years, goes digging through their junk pile and realizing they too have a cache of vertically oriented OXO. Oh,
they're going to have a cache. They're going to have one, and it'll be broken. Because they break. Mm-hmm.
Oh man, I am very happy that I am not this particular about my tools. And remember this when we have a 2-hour conversation about my computer.
I mean, I'm sure I wouldn't be as particular A if it didn't have RSI, and B if it didn't eat quite so much Parmesan cheese. But unfortunately, that's not both of those things I'm afflicted with.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Can you get a like mechanical grater or like an electric grater of some kind? Do those exist? Like for home use?
That's what I'm saying. I would like to get something that is not powered by something other than my hands, but I haven't found one that does the job. Lots of people recommend food processors. I have many food processors. I have big ones and small ones. The problem with most electric things is they go too fast and or the holes are the wrong size. Going too fast is bad because then you get heat and friction. You can't have any heat. You have to basically turn it like at hand speed. You don't want to produce any heat. You just want to, you know, grate the cheese slowly. And then the hole size, like the holes on this thing are very, very small, like smaller than the smallest side of a box grater, but the same shape as the big side of a box grater, like the little, I don't know, crater, inverted crater.
What do like places like Whole Foods, like what do they use? Just a big
thing? Yeah, they must have a machine. Obviously, it's probably not someone back there doing it by hand. Or if they do have a machine, it's probably with a really big crank, like a meat grinder size machine. I don't know what they use, but it's way too fine for me. They might use like, you know, the puckered side of a box grater where it's like a cross is cut in the middle and then the four triangles are pushed out a little bit.
I think so. Where it's like a slicing edge?
No, like I said, make a picture a piece of metal and now cut a plus sign in it, right? And now press on the plus sign from the inside so that the four little triangles formed by like the plus sign bend outward into like a little pyramid.
I've never seen
this. Oh, are you talking about like the handheld like swordy looking thing?
Oh my God. Chat room, tell me I did not describe this exactly correctly.
Are there just one of those on the side, or are there like a whole bunch?
A whole bunch.
I think I know what you mean, but I've never used that before.
Anyway, I think they might be using something like that, but whatever they use, it makes it incredibly fine. I mean, you know, it's very wispy. It's not bad. It's just not particularly to my taste, so I prefer it a little bit bigger than that.
Just use more.
It's a texture thing.
A microplane. That's what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of a microplane.
Microplanes are awesome.
No, it's not a microplane. The cost of like pre-grated Parmesan cheese is so expensive. Like pre-cut anything at Whole Foods.
Well, yeah. So since everyone will tell us, is there a reason you don't use a microplane style grater?
It doesn't make the right shavings. I have a microplane grater. It doesn't make it the right. That's not how I like it.
I guess you're stuck.
Yeah. We'll see. I've got a couple of years on the clock yet.
We hope.
Yeah.
Oh man, you know, just earlier today, I think it was, I listened to 99PI and they were talking about how we're going to eventually run out of sand. And I don't think that I personally have to worry about that, but I am very worried, John, about when you run out of cheese graters.
Speaking of the ambiguity, this cheese grater computer has outlived many of those plastic actual cheese graters. So it is clearly the king of all cheese graters.
Something like that. All right. Also in the show notes for follow-up, deviation from the IVE design philosophy. This sounds like a John thing to me. Tell me what's going on here.
I was thinking more about our discussion of Johnny IVE from last week and with his sort of philosophy potentially exiting the company with him. We'll see. We'll see what changes in the design of stuff that comes out. But one way his design has made itself known is, like, it extends everywhere. So I was thinking of the Apple mouse that I think Marco is using right now, or maybe you too, Casey.
Yep.
The mouse that should, and I was thinking about it because it's
the magic mouse?
Yep.
I was thinking about it because I was having dark thoughts about, like, who is it? It was because someone sent both of us that, like, that third party monitor, right?
Oh, yeah, the Planner iX, whatever. Yeah, we've seen it before. Yeah. I don't think Max can easily drive it, and it has those giant bezels and everything. Yet. Who cares?
Yeah, and someone's saying, like, it's basically like a 5K display right from an iMac, complete with the little hole for the camera, but there's no actual camera there in, like, the glass bonnet surface. Anyway, I was having dark thoughts about it, like, I can't believe Apple's going to sell you a computer and then, like, the only option is a $7,000 monitor or whatever, and they don't sell monitors. It would be like if they didn't sell a mouse and a keyboard, but they do sell mice and keyboards, and you can buy them with your computer. You can even pick which one you want, and they continue to make them, despite the fact that it's much easier to find a reasonable replacement mouse or keyboard than it is to find a reasonable replacement monitor. And so I was thinking about their peripherals. Like, obviously, the keyboard at this point, like, all of the margins are tucked in on the thing. Like, it's basically just a bunch of keys floating in space. Like, mm-hmm. How are those keys even there? Is there any space around them and between them? It's just keys, right? It's really boiled down to its essence again, the Johnny Ive philosophy. But the mouse I was thinking about, like, it is a very, you know, it fits with the Johnny Ive era design aesthetic. Because there are different ways a mouse could be designed. I think we had a show in the past where we had that diagram of all different ways people can hold a mouse. And it's not like the Apple mouse is, you know, designed badly, but it is designed for a particular way of using it. Like, it's a very low mouse, right? And some people like a sort of low profile mouse, and some people like a bigger thing that sort of fills your palm, right? And Microsoft has always made very large mice, and Logitech for that matter. Like, they're sort of made for you to grip under your entire hand, and they, you know, it's going to be pressing up against the back of your palm, you know, gripping. Whereas the Apple one is very slim and very low and very minimalist, and it fits with, if you put it next to Apple's computer, it looks like it fits. It's next to that keyboard, it makes sense. You know, obviously there's no cord on it. It's almost featureless. It looks like a flattened piece of sushi, right? You know, I mean, that you look at it and it looks like a little piece of art. And I was thinking, with Ive gone, if Apple's design philosophy changes a little bit, how far would be too far? And I was thinking even in terms of the mouse, because if Apple came out with a new mouse, which they do once every, what are they on, a decade plan now? Once every decade and a half, they come up with a new mouse, which is not unheard of. Apple does occasionally come out with new mice. Imagine if it was more of the shape of, like, a Microsoft mouse or a Logitech mouse, not in terms of the details, but in terms of, like, it's no longer a super low profile mouse. Like, I would say, you know, for my style of mousing, it would be more ergonomic for me. I don't like them to be that low because that's not how I hold the mouse, right? And, you know, if you make a low one, the people who want a high mouse aren't going to like it, and vice versa. So it's not like it's an incorrect or correct choice. But say Apple did make one that was still beautiful and Apple detailed, and, like, it still looked like an elegant piece of art, but it was basically fatter. Like, it was the fat mouse to go with, like, the fat Nano. It was bigger and fatter, and it filled your hand. It would be less elegant and less minimalist and less simple, because, like, if you could make a mouse slim and low, why would you make it big and fat? And the same, kind of the same way with the remote. If I can make a remote the size of a piece of chewing gum, why would I make it bigger? And the answer is, obviously, because human hands are big and chewing gum is small. And anyway, setting aside the remote for now, there's an argument to be made on the mouse that if you made it bigger, it might be easier for people to grip and find and use and manipulate, blah, blah, blah. But if Apple did that, people would look at that fat mouse, kind of like the fat Nano, and go, boy, Apple really needed Johnny Ive, because he left and they made this disgusting mouse that looks like a Microsoft mouse, looks like a Logitech mouse, doesn't look like an Apple mouse at all. And what I'm driving at is, like, the design philosophy evidenced by Apple's product during the Johnny Ive era has become so synonymous with Apple because he's been here so long and is such an important influence on so many important products that's what people think of as Apple-like. So even if Apple, the company, makes a Microsoft-style mouse, and even if it's a great mouse and people love it, they're going to look at it and say, ugh, that's not, like, it was better when Johnny Ive was here because look how inelegant this looks. Look how bloated it looks. Look how silly and comically large it looks. Like the eye of mouse was elegant and this is not. And I think that would be a shame because although the design philosophy embodied by Apple's current products and its past products for many years is a great one, it is not the only one, the only reasonable design philosophy, especially when it comes to peripherals. So I feel like our hope for the remote and maybe external keyboards and possibly mice, depending on how you feel about the current one, hinges on the public's willingness to accept anything that is not in line with the Johnny Ive minimalist essentialism design aesthetic. And I'm afraid that even if Apple makes a great product, but it's not a, sort of a Zen garden sculpture, beautiful Ive style thing, that they're going to get backlash for it. And I think that would be a shame.
Well, we do see like bits and pieces of pragmatism over appearance peeking through here and there. You know, one of the great examples in recent years are the iPhone smart battery cases, which by all objective accounts are kind of ugly. You know, they have that weird hump on the back. The first generation had like the weird centered mid hump, and the current generation has the weird like bottom hump, which I think is even uglier. But they do that for a few highly functional reasons. And we all did make fun of it when it came out, but it's actually a pretty reasonably successful product, as far as I can tell. We've owned a couple in our household, and they're good products. And Apple, it seems, was willing to make that trade off of like, look, we can't make this, beautiful and have it still function the way it needs to function. So they just didn't make it beautiful. They did, they kind of did the best they could with what they had to work with, and it came out, and it's a very useful utilitarian product. I think looking at the new Mac Pro case, it is not attractive. It's worse in pictures, but it's also not attractive in person. Like it's very much a utilitarian design. Like this is a big tower with a bunch of weird holes in the front. It's giant, it's heavy, it's bulky, it's weird looking, but it's all those things for utilitarian reasons. And for the customers who need that and who buy that, the utility of it is more important than the aesthetics. And so clearly, like Apple, even before I've officially left, Apple is able to occasionally let that peek through. And it seems like maybe in recent years, they're regaining their, what I would describe as confidence to ship something that doesn't look incredibly pretty, but is that way for functional reasons. It takes a certain degree of confidence to do that. Like they have to be able to ship something like with a straight face that they know many of us are going to say, ooh, that's ugly. Because they have to be confident enough in their design to be like, no, look, we know it's ugly, but it is this way for reasons. It was a trade-off, and this is what came out. So I don't think it's that unreasonable to predict that maybe they'll be doing more of that. Maybe they have kind of seen the light and have gotten enough customer feedback and enough sales data and everything over the last few years to be able to revert certain decisions. It's clear the Mac Pro is one of the biggest examples of that. We'll see, and we'll talk about later what might be happening with the laptops, in that department. But I think Apple had a really rough period where a whole lot of decisions were being made for aesthetics over utility. And we told them about it over and over and over again, and their customers told them about it over and over and over again. In some of these cases, their repair data told them about it. And I think there was a bad period that we are clearly on our way out of, that we're already partially out of it, and there seems like there's more to come. So I don't think it's that unreasonable to expect that we actually would have a chance of something like a more ergonomic mouse, although honestly, I like the mouse just fine, but I recognize a lot of people don't. I think we do have a chance of stuff like that. I think we do have a chance that the next Apple TV remote might be more ergonomic, for instance. I think we were in a dark period, but Apple has clearly shown recently that they are willing to put utility first with some of their new designs sometimes.
Yeah, that's why I was entertaining the possibility, because it seems like it is a possibility, but I think they'll get backlash. And I guess now that I think about it, it actually is mostly focused on if you're thinking of, cheese graters and OXO and all this stuff, on things that you grab with your hand, which there aren't many of them. Obviously, the phone itself is a thing that you grab, but there are limitations there where you can't really make it strange and knobbly because it does have to fit in pockets, and there are other concerns about it, right? But for peripherals, like for remote controls, for keyboards and for mice, for things that, like, it's your interface to the computer, you know, indirect controls that you grab, kind of like controls in cars, the steering wheel, the shift lever, the turn stalks, all that other stuff, like anything that you manipulate with your hands to make the stuff work. It's the place of highest tension between making something look beautiful, so it looks nice in your product shots, and so when it's in a museum 50 years from now, everyone oohs and ahs, and making something that's good to use with your hands. And there's not much of an intersection there. Like, it's why OXO products tend to look so ugly, right? Because, you know, the things that are easy and good to grip and manipulate tend not to be beautiful minimalist sculptures. Like, those are slippery or slim or pointy or don't match the negative space created by a gripping hand, because the negative space created by a gripping hand is ugly. As you know, if you grab a lump of clay and squeeze it real hard and then open your hand and look what's left, it's not a beautiful sculpture, but that's the inside of your hand. So I'm not saying a mouse has to look like a giant snail turd, like many of them do, but there are multiple styles of mice. You could make a fairly elegant mouse in a different style that is more of the hand-filling kind. But I feel like if Apple did that, there would be a surprising amount of backlash, especially given that, like, people would get used to it and everyone used mice like that and it would be fine. It would be better for the half of the population that likes it one way and worse for the people who like it the other way. But all you would hear about is how Apple made an ugly mouse.
I do think it's worth noting, though, that I think I speak for both of you, that we're not going to see, you know, like a pendulum swing dramatically the other direction. I mean, this design department has certainly been under Ive's leadership for, what, 20 years or something like that? A long time. And so I would certainly not expect, and I don't think you guys are trying to imply that you do expect, I don't think any of us expect that there's going to be some dramatic turn where you're going to see, like, the back of a snail for a mouse and things like that. But I do concur that it is certainly going to be interesting watching how often we see function over form going forward, because one of the things that I think the three of us agree on is, especially when it comes to things like the thickness of devices, it seemed that it was form over function. And so I'm curious to see how that changes going forward.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, by far my favorite web host. I've been with them now for over 8 years, way before they were a sponsor of our show. All of my servers are hosted at Linode for a reason. They have amazing hardware, amazing backing network behind it all, amazing support when you need it, and most of all, for me, it's an amazing value. For the entire 8 years I've been with Linode, there has never been a time when any other host has really competed with them on value for more than like a month. Like, it's been amazing. Linode is constantly the best value I've seen in the business for the entire 8 years I've been with them. It's not like it's, you know, one time sale and that's it after that. Literally the entire 8 years I've been with them, they've been an amazing value. So they have all sorts of great things: native enterprise grade SSDs, 40 gigabit network behind it all, Xeon processors, amazing support, amazing control panel. This is why I've been with them for so long, because it's just a really good web host. I've been with a lot of web hosts in my career, and Linode is by far my favorite one I've used. That's why I've been with them for the longest, and I'm the happiest with them that I've ever been. Check it out today at linode.com/ATP, and if you use promo code ATP2019, that can get you a $20 credit. Now, at Linode, that can actually go really far, because their cheapest plan starts at just $5 a month. That gets you a server with 1 gig of RAM in the Linode cloud in any of 10 data centers worldwide that you want. It's really an amazing service, an amazing value. I love Linode. You should too. If you need a server, you can do things like, you know, host Git repositories or entire web applications or CI, CD environments. Anything you need a server to do, check out Linode to do it. Once again, linode.com/ATP. Promo code ATP2019 for a $20 credit. That could be 4 months free on that 1 gig plan. And they have a 7-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. Thank you so much to Linode for hosting all my stuff and for sponsoring our show.
You have somehow fallen upon, it just happened to you, Marco, you have fallen upon a new iPhone and a new watch, question mark? What's going on here?
As you know, I'm running the betas on my main devices. I'm also working on a good, like, you know, mid-cycle update for Overcast for iOS 12 and watchOS 5, like the existing non-beta versions. And there's been a bug that I've been trying to replicate that people keep reporting, where when you're doing watch local playback, sometimes the seek back or seek forward buttons will skip instead to the next episode and will lose your position in the one you were in, which is a pretty serious bug. And I was trying to replicate it on my beta devices, and I just couldn't. Now, it is impossible to downgrade an Apple Watch from the beta. And theoretically, maybe I could bring it to an Apple store and have them send it out and have them do it, but I'm nowhere near an Apple store. That would be a big pain, et cetera. So that wasn't really an option for me. I also didn't want to go that long without it for various testing reasons. I also have this other problem that I only have my one iPhone here with me at the beach, and I'm doing a lot of development, and I don't have an iOS 12 test device. So I briefly decided to borrow Tiff's phone and Tiff's Apple Watch to try to run a test. She did not appreciate this at all. So I really needed something. I needed test devices that I could test the regular GM version and the beta. So I have my regular ones that I could test the betas on, but I really needed another test device. I needed another Apple Watch running watchOS 5 that I wouldn't put on the beta, and I needed a phone running iOS 12 to pair it to. What would you do in this situation?
Well, what I would do, because I'm cheap, is that I would go back to my house and go get ones that I already had, but I'm cheap. If I'm Marco, I would next day air myself some new devices.
I think that's what most developers do, is they keep their old phones to use as test devices instead of immediately selling them.
I do keep a lot of my old phones, not all of them, but a lot of them. I, however, didn't keep any old Apple Watches. Like, I have my Series 0 for just, like, nostalgia's sake in a drawer that I haven't powered on, and the battery's probably deeply discharged and totally unusable now. It probably won't even boot anymore. But, because, by the way, that happens with Apple Watches. If you leave them in a drawer for a few years and don't charge them, you will never be able to charge them again. They'll never power on again, in all likelihood. The battery totally dies. I also have this other problem. I never got an iPhone SE. For the last few years, my 4-inch test device was my old iPhone 5S. And that worked fine, except that now the 5S no longer works on the new version of the OS. So my 4-inch test device, which I left at home, I didn't bring to the beach, but my 4-inch test device is no longer going to be a useful test device once iOS 13 ships, and I have to run that on it. So I actually kind of wanted an iPhone SE. So I know it's discontinued, but I went on Amazon. I'm like, you know what? What do they actually cost? And it turns out you can get an iPhone SE not refurbished, because that means more, but renewed, which means very little, it's basically very used. You can get a renewed iPhone SE unlocked on Amazon for about $120. And that's really pretty good, I thought. So I put one of those in my cart, and I thought, okay, now I got to have an Apple Watch to pair to it. What do used Apple Watches cost? Like, and I didn't want to go super low-end for the Apple Watch, because the build-and-run cycle on Apple Watches improves drastically as you go more and more recent. But I thought, you know, I'm probably going to have to, if I want something cheap, I'm probably going to have to go Series 2. But it turns out you can get Series 3 Apple Watches, which is only, you know, last year's model, basically. You can get a Series 3 Apple Watch. I got Series 3 42mm cellular in stainless steel for $240.
Wow, that's pretty cheap.
You know, the only reason I got the stainless steel and the cellular was it was only $20 more to get steel and cellular. I'm like, all right, sure. And so I got both of these in. They came in the kind of packaging, if you sell your phone or watch to Apple or Gazelle or one of those companies, they send you basically a sheet of cardboard with shrink wrap over it, and you just kind of shove your device into that. You know those things?
Yeah.
Amazon ships a lot of stuff in that. Yep, it's like, yep. we put, it's like when you're injured and they put you on one of those stiff backboard things and then just like wrap you with saran wrap so you're stuck to it. That's how your products come.
Exactly. So both the watch and the phone, which came from different companies, they both came in those kind of just like, you know, plastic hold, like sticking it to a piece of cardboard.
That's how Apple intended them to be presented to the customers, I believe. They spent a lot of time working on that presentation.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a piece of brown corrugated cardboard and then saran wrap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you have an entire iPhone for $120, you don't get such luxuries as genuine Apple chargers. Like, it was shipped with like a generic, definitely not MFI lightning cable and little USB power brick.
it comes with a wire coat hanger that's already been unwound for you, so you can just shove one end to the lightning connector and you shove the other end into an outlet.
Right, exactly. And the Apple Watch has clearly been put on a generic knockoff sport band. It looks very similar to the Apple white sport band. And if I didn't own many white Apple sport bands, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference, maybe, but because I own them and I have one right here, right next to it, I can tell there's very much a difference.
You would tell when it starts to melt on your wrist.
Yeah. Yeah. But still, you know, it's still an Apple Watch. And the Apple Watch did appear to come with a genuine Apple charging cable, because I don't think it's as easy to come by generic Apple Watch charging cables as it is for other things.
Did you look on the back of the Apple Watch to make sure it doesn't say APPEL or anything like that?
I mean, no, like, it's real. It's and it's stainless steel.
Is it filled with sawdust? Does it turn on? I mean,
the thing is, like, it works. Like, so both of these things, I plugged them in and they both work fine. Like, there's a few dings on the cases. Like, there's, you know, like the iPhone especially has like a corner dent on one corner. But like, everything works, you know, there were no scratches on the screens. Everything is fine. They charged up. The battery seemed to be totally fine. There were a couple of interesting takeaways for me using this phone for the last couple of days. I haven't been using it full time. I didn't put my SIM in it, but I have been playing with it a lot, like in the house, like leaving my big iPhone XS behind, like on a countertop, and just taking the SE with me and playing with it for a while. And a couple of things jump out at me from this thing. So number one, first of all, I think it's hilarious that the Apple Watch costs a lot more than the phone. But I still think that, you know, $240 for last year's model of stainless steel cellular 42 millimeter Apple Watch is a really good deal. And it kind of struck me, like, if you're willing to not have the latest and greatest, and if you're willing to go used, you can get surprising discounts on Apple stuff. Like, I if you would have just asked me before I looked, like, how much I thought these things would cost, I would have guessed substantially higher than what they actually do. So that's, you know, number one, like, that's, it's kind of cool that this is available. And like, for $120, this is a lot of phone, actually. Like, it's not a bad deal at all. I would imagine, like, if I really wanted to get something a little more versatile, I would probably go for an old iPhone 7, which probably isn't that much, you know, maybe those might be like $200 or something. I don't know. I haven't looked that up, but like, I was surprised like how nice it was for that price. And the watch, especially, you know, $240 to get what was a year ago, I think a $700 configuration is pretty awesome. So a few other things jumped out at me just for, you know, fun discussion's sake. When you've had a Series 4 Apple Watch and you've had then the pulled in corners, like the more rounded corners, the shrunk bezels, and the Apple Watch faces that go more edge to edge, the old Apple Watch looks incredibly old when you see the screen turn on.
Thanks, buddy.
You're welcome.
Still on the Series 3.
But you haven't gotten used to it. Like, when you go to the Series 4,
I would feel the same way.
It really is, like, especially like using my favorite face, the utility one, you know, like the basic round clock with all the good stuff, that face looks comical on the old one when you're used to the new one, because it just gets this massive black border around it. So Series 4 was actually a surprising upgrade in a lot of ways. But I will say, otherwise, you know, that it's fine. It performs well, and it's just as buggy as the Apple Watch always is. The iPhone SE has actually been pleasantly nice. I haven't used this size phone for more than, you know, 5 minutes of testing since it was new, since I owned the iPhone 5S. And it's actually a really good size in a lot of ways. I'm surprised how well certain things still work on it. Like, I'm surprised certain things, you know, first of all, you pick it up, it looks awesome and it feels awesome. And I heard on one of our friends' podcasts, I forget which one, I apologize, but I heard recently there was a discussion of, like, what do you think are Johnny Ive's, like, greatest designs? And I would put very high on the list the iPhone 5S.
Yeah.
It is such, like, I remember when John Gruber reviewed the iPhone 5, he said in his review that it was such a nice object. It was, like, the nicest object he owned. The iPhone 5S, I think, refined a lot of it. And the SE took away the polished chamfered edge, which made it less nice. But that's why I think, like, from a design perspective, the iPhone 5S was kind of the peak of it. And it is just such a great device. It is timeless looking. I still think it looks good. Even, you know, holding this SE in my hand, it's an old phone now, very old now, and it's based on the even older 5S. But it is this wonderful, like, the space gray with the black, you know, little cellular windows on top and bottom. This is a fantastic, timeless, really nice design. And if you consider design to be the combination of how it looks and how it works, I think the iPhone 5S really was the peak of that entire class of iPhone before they got big. I really, really enjoy this device as a physical object. And secondly, the using it. Now, when I'm accustomed to the bigger phones now, so certain things like typing are really hard. Once you're accustomed to the big phone, it's really hard to go down a size for typing. Like, I made so many errors just like typing my passcode and stuff. But once you get past that, or once you get accustomed to that, the interface actually scales down fairly well on most things. Like, there were a few screens here and there that, like, something would fall off the bottom because nobody tested it. But it actually scales really well. And certain things like deleting a mail message by swiping. I know it's a stupid thing, but it's something I do all day long. It feels much smoother and better on the 5S than it does on my 10S. On the SE than it does on my 10S. And I don't know if it's just because it has fewer pixels, maybe it's running things at a higher frame rate because it has so many fewer pixels to drive, or if it's something about the digitizer that's different, or that it's just my finger is moving less distance because it's a smaller screen. Who knows? But certain things about this size just feel really good. And it's like feelings that I've missed since I use this size on a regular basis. So, I mean, I don't really have any conclusion here. I'm not suggesting anybody go back and use this because it is, you know, it's an iPhone 6S internals. So it is kind of the bottom of what's supported by iOS 13. And I would expect iOS 14 probably won't support it. But it was kind of nice going back to the size just to play around with and to see, like, in certain ways, it feels like the past. Like when you view certain things and you see quite how narrow your text column is, or like, you know, Instagram looks hilarious by comparison. But like, it is actually a really nice feeling phone, and for $120, surprisingly usable. So that's it. That's all I had on this segment.
I feel like this. We've talked so much about phone sizes on this show, but it's an issue that's never going to go away if phones continue to be things with screens on them that you hold in your hands, because there's always that tension between there's the size of your hand and the motions that are most comfortable for adult hands and fingers to make. And there's a range there, obviously, because people have different size hands, but still, it's, you know, you could define that range. And then there's the screen, where we want to see more stuff all the time. And you have to find the sweet spot between how much stuff do you want to see, and how comfortable is it to hold in your hand, to manipulate, to stick in your pocket? And those two things will never meet. There is no perfect compromise. So we'll always kind of be oscillating depending on your... So if at any point, if we're in a big phone error or a small phone error or somewhere in between, you pick another extreme, you will find things about it that are better than whatever size phone you're using, because those two things are always in conflict with each other. There is no point where they'll, you know, find each other exactly in the middle and will be like, I will never notice any benefit by going smaller or larger. You will notice benefits going larger, and you'll notice benefits going smaller and disadvantages. And, you know, it's a constant compromise until we get Apple glasses or whatever, where we can sort of divorce the I want to see as much information as possible, but I don't want to have something the size of a brick in my pocket. And, you know, I can't put an iPad in my inside jacket pocket because I'm not David Smith.
That's another thing. Like, this thing feels like nothing in my pocket, because I'm used to the 10S, and before that the 10, the 5 or the SE feels like nothing. It feels like it's smaller than my wallet. I mean, it's like it's really very small, and it's very lightweight compared. You know, the new phones are surprisingly heavy. Like, when you feel the old ones, you realize quite how light the old ones were, and the 5 generation was an especially light generation of phone because it didn't have the glass back. And it feels so good in so many ways. Like, the sleep-wake button's in a good spot. There's a headphone jack on the bottom. The volume up and down buttons feel great. I really, like, there was that rumor that came out, I think, last week. We didn't have time to cover it in our show, but there was a rumor, I think, from Ming-Chi Kuo that either this year's or, I think, next year's iPhones, the one that I use, the 10S line, the screen is going to get a little bit smaller, and then the Max line, the screen is going to get a little bit bigger. And at first, I thought, that's such a slap in the face for 10S owners. Like, here, you get to either have a smaller thing or pay even more and get a much bigger thing. But actually, I think I might take that trade-off, because it turns out, like, if you can take what you already have and get most of that for a little bit smaller, It's kind of nice. I really like the way this tiny phone feels. And you know what? The XS is a little bit big. So I think maybe I would enjoy going a little bit smaller than that.
That sort of the bouncing around I was talking about, where, you know, you're sort of, there are extremes and you're trying to find the sweet spot, but you're always oscillating back and forth. Those oscillations let you, from generation to generation, or maybe 2 year or 3 year gap or whatever, let you get a phone. And no matter which direction you're going, you'd be like, oh, there's some aspect of this that I find agreeable, whether it's like the other screen felt too cramped or this feels better in my pocket. There's always an advantage for you, but then also a disadvantage, so that when they oscillate slightly back, you know, maybe the oscillations are getting smaller or narrowing down on a compromise that's reasonable. But I think the oscillations are an important part of the product line. Like, there should never come a time where Apple feels like they have exactly correctly struck the balance between size, weight, screen, real estate, all of those things. Like, they should always oscillate, because the oscillation will make any new phone in any oscillation, any direction, feel good and interesting and make people not regret their purchase. And then, you know, eventually when what the negative aspects get annoying, in 2 years, they'll buy another phone.
Declan, well, both the kids use some iPhone app, I don't even remember what it's called, as like a little noise machine while they're sleeping. And Declan's using a 5S as his noise machine, has for like 4 years now or whatever it's been. And I don't often pick it up. Usually I just, you know, leave it on his bedside table and just interact with it on the table. But when I do pick it up, every time I do, I'm just gobsmacked by how perfectly it fits in my hand. And maybe your hand is bigger than mine, maybe your hand is smaller than mine. But for me, the 5S just fits perfectly in my hand. And so for a fleeting moment, I think to myself, why the hell am I carrying this tremendous, like, phablet, which it really isn't, but it feels like a phablet by comparison, of an iPhone 10 in my pocket every day. But then if I ever open any app but the sleep machine app or the noisemaker app, and I can see like six words of text on screen, then suddenly I remember why I have this comparatively enormous phone in my pocket. And yeah, I think you're right, John, that, you know, I don't think we've struck the exact right balance. I do think the 10 is a little bit big for my taste, but, you know, at least I'm not one of those, you know, plus or max monsters, you know, like Mike Hurley is. I don't know how that guy survives.
It's funny, like, you know, when I first start using it, I think the same thing, like, wow, what a tiny little window that I'm seeing all this content in. But like, as I play with it, it's so damn fast. Like, it for the phone that is the lowest end supported phone for the new OS, it sure is fast on iOS 12. Like, it is surprising how fast it is. And it just, not, I'm not, you know, benchmarking, but just like, just the way it feels to do things. Like, I mentioned the mail thing earlier. Like, and again, I don't know whether it's just that my fingers need to travel less distance, so like it's just like faster in wall clock time to do certain things or not. But it just feels, it's almost like I've been driving an SUV for the last 5 years, and then I get into a Miata. It's just like you, it just feels so nimble because you can just fly around it so fast because you're not spending any time adjusting your grip at all or reaching across long distances at all. It's just really, really nice and surprisingly fast in basic operation for such an old device. So I don't think I could ever switch to one, you know, that's this small full time again, just because I do so often use things that really want a bigger screen. But boy, is it nice to play around with this sometime. We are sponsored this week by Boosted. Instead of sitting in traffic and searching for parking or riding a bus, imagine riding the streets with the wind in your hair on your own Boosted electric vehicle. It's so much better than sitting in traffic. You can be out in the world, exploring, creating, and having fun. Use Boosted to get where you need to be faster. Using Boosted vehicle-grade electric skateboards and scooters, these are the modern solution to your transportation woes. With a 22-mile range and max speeds of 24 miles an hour, Boosted is perfect for both running to the store and traveling across town. And these are high-grade electric vehicles. They're designed to provide a luxurious experience. So it's no wonder that Boosted was one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. With five options to pick from, including their new scooter, the Boosted Rev, there is a personal electric vehicle from Boosted that is tailor-made to you. And they start at just $61 a month with financing, so there is no better time to change how you move than now. So right now, Boosted is offering $75 off the purchase of an electric vehicle when you use the code ATP at checkout. So go to boostedboards.com and it's code ATP at checkout. So once again, boostedboards.com, promo code ATP at checkout for $75 off your vehicle. Thank you so much to Boosted for sponsoring our show.
So you have new toys. I want a new toy, guys.
Oh, no.
Over the, what was it, yesterday that Apple announced that they've done me some good things and they have done me some bad things. So Apple has refreshed the MacBook Air and the 13-inch MacBook Pro. But they have killed my beloved Adorable. The MacBook One, also known as the MacBook Adorable, also known as just plain MacBook.
The 12-inch MacBook.
It's dead, you guys. Mine is fine. I mean, it's still slower than shit, but it's dead. But officially, it's dead. And so I don't know what to do. I would like to talk about what I should do from here. But before we get to that, we should probably run through the changes that have come from Apple over the last 24 hours. So the MacBook Air now has True Tone. It is now down $100. So instead of being $1,200, it is now $1,100. And importantly, $999 for students. So that's a big deal. The 13-inch MacBook Pro is now on 8th generation quad-core CPUs. It is $1,299 to $1,300, which is the same price as the Escape once was. And like I said, the MacBook Adorable is dead. The MacBook Escape also dead. Apparently, Apple just really hates our nicknames almost as much as Stephen Hackett does.
I will say, though, there is a significant reframing going on here about what happened to the Escape. The Escape is not dead. There are still two very different 13-inch MacBook Pro models, one of which uses 15-watt TDP CPUs, one of which uses 28-watt CPUs. The 15-watt one still has only two ports. The 28-watt has four ports. What happened is not that the Escape went away. What happened is that the Escape got a touch bar.
Well, it's not the Escape anymore. I mean,
exactly.
lost the Escape. The Escape is definitely dead. Because the MacBook Escape was, yes, the computer with all the slow stuff inside it, but it was the one with the Escape key. And so that one's dead.
I know. The name is dead, but the computer lives on. Like they're still selling two very different computers as kind of the same thing. It just had two different price points. But it's like, oh, this one has only two ports, and this one has four ports, and the CPU clock speeds are very different. The internals are completely differently laid out. Like, it's a very different machine. So the Escape is not dead. We just can't call it that anymore because it got a touch bar. But it is still...
What do we call it? The touch bar Escape? our names are getting as unwieldy as Apple's actual names.
I know, right?
Touch Bar Escape late 2019.
I like what Style Dash suggested in the chat, which is MacBook Unescaped.
Actually, like, I'll get to that later during Ask ATP. But anyway, so that's what. So these are some really odd updates. I mean, so first of all, the MacBook Air got quote updated, but the only changes. Our display got True Tone, which is very minor. The price got lowered. And I've also heard that the SSD is slower, which might accommodate for the price lowering.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, the MacBook Air is a pretty recent computer. Like, it's not overdue for an update. So I'm surprised they got any updates at all.
Right. And what's extra weird about this is that there is that the Ming-Chi Kuo thing last week. He says that the MacBook Air is with the new scissor keyboard is coming out this fall. So this to me, I hesitate to call this an update. I think this is more like when last fall or last winter, whenever it was, like December, whenever it was, when Apple slightly revised the 2018 15-inch MacBook Pro by simply adding a new Vega GPU option to it. So it wasn't really a full-blown update. It was just like a slight adjustment to what was available for it. I think this is kind of like that. I think they've taken the 2018 MacBook Air and they've finally given it by default the new revised third gen butterfly keyboard with the new materials, right? So that's one change that has definitely happened here. We got that confirmed somewhere. It has True Tone, which is very, very minor, and it has apparently possibly a slower SSD, which probably allowed it to drop that price down a little bit. It seems more like a slight revision that was timed specifically to capture the back-to-school market, which for the MacBook Air is a pretty substantial buying period. I think they sell a whole lot of these for students in the summertime. So I think this is being presented PR-wise as a refresh to the MacBook Air, but it really, I don't think it really is one. I think it's a very slight mid-cycle tweak that is mostly a price drop and a few very small modifications to achieve that. But I think that's about it. The Escape change is more substantial because that one got completely new CPUs that are now quad-core. Before it was dual-core at the 15-watt level. So the Escape now got the quad-core CPUs, a T2, and the Touch Bar. It didn't have any of those things before. And it got the new keyboard, or, you know, the new old keyboard. The Escape before this had the 2017 keyboard. It didn't even have the membrane from summer 2018. It missed that cycle completely. So the Escape, or what is now, the artist formerly known as the Escape, got an actual real genuine update. That it is like a real, like, nice 12 to 18 month style update. But the Air, I wouldn't call what happened to the Air an update. And that's why I think that the Ming-Chi Kuo rumor about a new Air coming out this fall with a new keyboard, I don't think this, quote, update invalidates that or makes that much less likely. I think these can both be true, that the MacBook Air got this small revision this summer to make it a little bit cheaper, but that it might also be getting replaced this fall. Because Apple's been updating things more frequently. You know, they went through the bad period of, you know, the 2016 era, you know, updating things on a very slow cycle and making everything worse with every update that they did do. But now, they, like, in the last couple of years, they have shown a pattern of updating the laptops whenever, or at least updating the laptops that matter to them. I should definitely have had that. Updating the laptops that matter to them whenever they can. Like, basically, whenever there is something new to update to, they do it. Like, they did the mid-cycle GPU update. They did this 2018 revision, like, this spring, and, you know, like, to brand new things as soon as they could. Like, so I'm guessing that whatever rumor stuff is coming out with the new keyboard this fall/this winter/next spring, whenever all that stuff happens, I think that's still going to happen. I don't think these updates necessarily preclude that, simply because that would only be like 6 months from now.
I know I'm not the biggest laptop fan, but I mean, I continue to look at these various revisions, new materials, reshuffling of the line as just like, who cares until they get a new keyboard? Like, my brain is just turned off to the notion of Apple laptops until they deal with the keyboard. It's kind of like with the Mac Pro. It's like, you know, are you going to come out with the Mac Pro? Until it comes out, like, I don't care. Like, don't, you know, only they keep shipping products. Unlike the Mac Pro, which was never actually updated. They keep shipping products, but it's like, okay, fine. But, you know, I can't recommend these to people without a big, long explanation about the keyboards. Like, we're still kind of in that holding pattern. So I think it's great that they're updating them and simplifying the line and all that other stuff. But it's like, does it matter? Like, it's not deck chairs on the Titanic because it's not going down. Like, they are going to make computers with the new keyboard that presumably will be better. And honestly, we haven't even heard, at least I haven't, whether the new materials have solved the problem. Maybe they have. Maybe the new materials actually solved the reliability problem and we're just left with the key layout and typing feel, which is a thing that some people may like and some people may not like. But I've just given up on this whole line. It was like, revise them all you want. Make new. I'm just waiting for the new laptops. And it'll be great if they come out with the Air and the other one. But then we'll be like, okay, well, who's left? Who's left still with the old keyboard, right? Until we can wholeheartedly recommend it. Because I would almost wholeheartedly recommend the new Air if it had a different keyboard. You know, a couple minor tweaks here and there, but like, I can't get excited about these revisions. And, you know, getting rid of the Escape makes sense to me because that computer never really made much sense. And, you know, sort of folding it in to be a sheep in wolf's clothing, so to speak. It's got a touch bar and everything, but it's half the ports and half the number of cores and everything. I think the only part of this that I'm interested in is the MacBook One getting canned, because I kind of loved that machine, that it existed. I didn't love that it was slow. I always hoped that it would travel the same path as the original Air, where it started off as an oddity, pushing the boundaries of technology, and then eventually got its feet under it and mm-hmm. became a really great computer. And it seems like the MacBook One never really got that chance. Like, it was an oddity, and it pushed the boundaries of technology, and it got like 1 foot under it, and then it just was thrown in the garbage can. So, obviously, it is the most awesome and obvious candidate for a revision to have an ARM CPU, to have even better battery life and even less power. I do wonder if there's room in that form factor for the scissor switch keyboards with double travel. Maybe with an ARM CPU, there'll be more room inside there. Shove everything out of the way of the keyboard, and there'll still be enough room for the battery for that tiny little ARM CPU. So if and when the ARM Macs come out, I'll really be looking forward to the resurrection of... We're going to have to call it the Adorable. That was CGP Grey who came out with the Adorable.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we're going to have to call it that, because I really hope that if they do resurrect this computer as an ARM computer, it will have more than one port. But who knows? Apple is stubborn. They could stick to one port. But yeah, it just seems like the MacBook One was too thin to live, right? Like, you can't. I would imagine you can't put in the current MacBook One. You can't swap out that keyboard for one with more travel, because of all the computers Apple sells, this is the one where you need a low travel keyboard, because it is so thin. And I really think that what would have made that product great is to have a really, really good, powerful CPU in there. And there's nothing from Intel, apparently, that fits the bill to be able to fit in a fanless enclosure that is, way faster. But there are a bunch of CPUs in fanless enclosures and products made by Apple that are really fast, much faster than the MacBook One, that would really make that machine kick butt. So I really hope it comes back to us later in the ARM era. But yeah, and until then, wake me up when there's a new keyboard.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. I mean, I think that pretty much everybody in this racket would guess, like, yeah, if anything's going to come out with an ARM version, the tiniest little 12-inch MacBook was one of the top candidates to have it first. But I think in general, like, I was very surprised that it was canceled. I have since heard from a number of different people, apparently sales of it were very low. That it didn't sell well, and I can't say I'm surprised by that, because I think what we've seen in the laptop line over the last while now. Remember the MD whatever 101. It was the 13-inch non-Retina MacBook Pro with the DVD drive that was kept in the lineup forever. I think it was a 2011 model, I think, or a 2012 model maybe, and it was kept in the lineup until like 2016 or something, because people just kept buying the thing. Like, no matter what else Apple released, they sold a ton of those MD-101s, because it was a roughly $1,100 computer. So it was like an inexpensive, by Apple standards, an inexpensive laptop. You could replace the hard drive and the RAM easily down the road. It was serviceable long term. It was cheap to spec up. You could put a spinning disk in there, back when everything else Apple sold used SSDs only. So it was like, it was much cheaper to spec up. It had a DVD drive, so that was like one less thing people had to worry about, like one less limitation that they had with the computer. And yeah, it was non-Retina, but everyone, mostly didn't care. And so it was they sold a ton of those 101s, because it was just like a very practical, cheap, very versatile computer, as long as you were willing to take something that wasn't particularly new. And when they eventually discontinued that, what replaced it in that role was the 13-inch MacBook Air, the old one. Again, like, by that time, that was actually a pretty old computer as well. It was also like, non-Retina, also 13 inches, also about $1,100. It was like, you can see a lot of parallels here. It didn't have the replaceable RAM or hard drive, or it didn't have the DVD drive, but it was a very similar thing of like, Apple had lots of other computers that were nicer and newer and above it in the line, but people kept buying that thing in droves because it was a great value, and it was highly versatile. It would satisfy almost anyone's needs. So if you look at the 12-inch in this context, it never could reach that point. It was not anywhere near versatile enough, and they either couldn't or wouldn't make it cheap enough to ever take that role. And so if you were a person going into an Apple store wanting to buy a laptop for yourself and you wanted something at the lower end, why would you get the 12-inch when you could get, until recently, the crappy old 13-inch MacBook Air, which was actually a pretty great computer if you didn't care about Retina? Like, you could get that for the same or less money, and have better specs, as long as you didn't care about Retina. And it wasn't, it was bigger and heavier, but, you know, most people didn't care that much compared to what they got for that money. And so really what Apple needs in that range of the lineup is better value and more versatility. And that's something that the 12-inch MacBook just couldn't get. The 12-inch had a lot of fans. Well, it had no fan, but you know what I mean. It had a lot of customers. Almost everyone I knew who had one, you included, Casey, almost everyone I knew who had one had a bit of a love-hate relationship with it. Like, I know very few people who bought only one. Usually you'd buy one and it was slow as hell, and then they would revise it and it would be 5% faster, and you'd be like, okay, take my money. I need every drop of performance I can get because it's still so slow. I'll take the 5% faster. And yep. It was just so slow and so limited. And using that one port was so annoying because if you wanted to plug in power and anything else, you would need a dongle. So it was like laughably annoying to own this computer. But a lot of people did enjoy it anyway because it was so damn small and so damn light. And so I see there is a role for that. But I think what this probably confirms, first the, you know, going almost 2 years without an update and then being quietly killed, I think what this kind of confirms is, like, just not enough people are willing to tolerate all those trade-offs. Like, the 12-inch, a lot of people try to compare it to the MacBook Air, but it really is a very different computer because it takes way more trade-offs to get it to where it is than the MacBook Air did. Even the old 11-inch MacBook Air needed fewer trade-offs than what the 12-inch MacBook needed. The 12-inch MacBook was a massive pile of massive trade-offs to get, you know, a little bit smaller, a little bit lighter. And most people just weren't willing to make those trade-offs.
And like the original Air, like I said, a huge amount of trade-offs to get a little bit thinner. You know, it can fit in a manila envelope, but honestly, it was basically just like take an existing Apple laptop and make it have a taper. But if the Air had not, imagine if the original Air, like the next one that came out was 5% better. And then, it wouldn't be, you know, you needed that big jump with the 2011 model or whatever when they did the revised one. It's like, finally, this is a really good computer now. And so suddenly it, you know, all the attractive attributes are still attractive, and they got rid of all the downsides. And I just felt like they couldn't do that with the One. Like, there was, if they could have made the MacBook One, they could have taken two directions. One is it could have become like the Air, where it's the computer that's good enough for everybody and it's inexpensive and super light. And the other direction they could have taken it, if they couldn't do that, is make it the luxury model. If they could have made the MacBook One three times faster and add hundreds of dollars to the price, it would have been like, oh, if you have tons of money, you can get this amazing computer. It's super fast and it's incredibly small. But there was no option to do that. Like, there is no CPU they could put in there that could do that, right? So with ARM, I feel like they have both options on the table. They can make this a good enough for everybody computer that also happens to be ridiculously thin, basically a resurrection of the 2011 MacBook Air, the one we say, why would you not get this one? If you need, unless you need more than three ports, I'm getting greedy, right? More than two ports, maybe, get this model because it's fast enough for you and it's so thin and it's got a new keyboard and you'll love it and it's great, right? Or they could put, you know, the fastest of the fast iPad CPU in there and say, like, this is expensive, but boy, is it thin and it's super fast and it's got four ports on it or something. So I think we'll be seeing a computer like this again in our future, but it could never get out of its own way. It spent its entire time with the the spinning disk in the original MacBook Air, like 120 gig, or 80 gig. It was like the iPod hard drive in there, right?
Yeah, it was literally an iPod hard drive.
It's no good.
So, as someone who has lived with one and only one MacBook Adorable / MacBook One, I did only purchase one. I think that's because I got the most recent one, and then they killed it. And so I agree with what you had said earlier, Marco. I would have taken the underscore approach where if they had revved this today, I probably would have already placed an order. Not definitely, but probably. And having lived with this computer for 2 years, especially when I was in my anti-iPad days, which was basically up until the new iPad Pros last fall, it was amazing. Yeah, it was a little bit slow, but it was rare usually. Up until Vignette, it was rare that I was doing anything that really required a whole lot of oomph on it. And so it was this, it was basically an iPad that was an actual computer. Haha, yes, I know. I'm not trying to start that fight. I'm just saying, like, it was an iPad that ran OS X or Mac OS. And that was amazing. That was so amazing. And I loved that so much. And I still do love this computer, but as I'm doing ever more development on it, I am finding that I am ever more annoyed with how slow it really is. And so, you know, a couple people lit me up on Twitter saying, how could you need to replace a two-year-old computer? I haven't needed to replace a two-year-old computer in a decade or something like that. And yeah, that's true.
They weren't buying the 12-inch.
But yeah, buy the 12-inch MacBook, which was underpowered the moment I bought it. And I knew that. I knew it, and I did it anyway. And the reason I did it anyway was because I wanted something ultra-hyper-portable. And that was the number one priority to me. And in that, this thing has succeeded tremendously because it is unbelievably portable. However, it is dog slow. And the other problem I have with it is that it only has one port. And it is not often that I want to plug in two things, but it is also not rare. And so just earlier tonight, it has decided that the Time Machine backup on my Synology is somehow corrupt and it would like to start over and make a new one. And so I thought, okay, I'm probably going to have to plug in Ethernet. And you remember the days when Ethernet was just in the computer? But anyway, I'm going to have to plug in an Ethernet adapter. Oh, wait, that means I need to go get my dongle. Oh, and the Ethernet adapter and the dongle are across the room, and I'm recording right now, so I guess I'm not doing that, am I? And that just gets frustrating. Or, hey, I would really like to plug in my phone to debug and also be plugged into power. Yes, it's dongle time. Like, it's just... stuff like that is very frustrating. And so I really wonder, and I based on zero empirical evidence other than my own experience, but I can't help but wonder, if this thing had two ports, would it have sold twice as well, or, you know, or considerably better? And there's no way for us to know. But the one port thing was very, very frustrating, particularly once I started developing with it, when I really would want to plug in a phone and not have to do it via a dongle. So, you know, I have a USB-C to Lightning cable, which works great, but then I can't power the thing. And so then, especially now I'm asking this dog slow CPU to do something that requires a lot of CPU power. So now I'm murdering my battery and I'm charging my phone off of the laptop battery. So I'm murdering it twice over.
And it's getting hot because it's fanless.
Exactly. So it's like the perfect storm of awful for this computer. And I still love this computer. And I will always love this computer because it is such an unbelievably cool piece of technology. But I don't think it's the right one for me anymore. And so that's why I said I would have probably bought a revved version earlier today if such a thing existed. But I've gotten to the point that I really think that I need more power. And we are skipping a little bit ahead, but this is a perfect segue to the field trip I took today to the Apple Store. And I went to the Apple Store today because I thought to myself, we're going to talk about this tonight, and I want to handle a 13-inch Air and a 13-inch MacBook Pro, because the last 13-inch Air I've handled is Aaron's, which not only has it been underwater several times, but...
yeah, you're still allowed to handle it?
Yeah, well, that's true. But I don't even remember how old that thing is, but it's easily 4 or 5 years old. It is not young at this point. It might even be older than that. I don't recall. I don't even know what version of macOS is on it. It might even be a version of OS X. That's how old it is. But anyway, you get my point. And that thing is big and it's heavy compared to my adorable. It is enormous compared to my adorable. And I don't really have experiences with 13-inch Pros or 13-inch Airs other than that one. So I went to the Apple Store today and I went looking at the Escape, because it was still an Escape in my store at this point. And I went looking at the Pro, and then I went looking at the Air as well. And as it turns out, these things have gotten crazy light over the last few years. Who knew? So I was looking at them.
You've been working out.
And I'm looking at these things, and I actually brought my computer. You know, I brought my computer bag with me with my laptop in it. And of course, I feel like I'm looking as though I'm preparing to steal these things. But be that as it may, I'm trying to look confident. And if you look confident, that's halfway to getting away with anything. So I, you know, pull my Adorable out of my laptop bag, and I have that in my right hand, and I'm closing and picking up these, you know, display units in my left hand. And I went and did a little bit of research because my name is not John Siracusa, and I'm allowed to. And in 2017, I paid $1,744.82 for my loaded MacBook Adorable. It was as loaded as I could get it, which, by the way, I thought I paid like over $2,000 for that. So it was cheaper than I remember it being. But anyway, it is listed as 2.03 pounds. So for all intents and purposes, 2 pounds. The 13-inch Air, as I looked at Apple's website earlier tonight, is 2.75 pounds. So that's effectively 3/4 of a pound heavier. It is also, the way I would have configured, or would configure it, it is $1,900. That is not the base config, as we've said before. This is the way I would configure it, which is the 1.6 gigahertz Core i5, the 16 gigs of memory, 1 terabyte SSD, and that, of course, has 2 Thunderbolt 3 ports. How amazing would that be, ladies and gentlemen? It has 2 ports. Imagine that. And so I'm handling this MacBook Air, and I'm handling my MacBook Adorable, and I realize there's really not a lot of difference here. There is certainly a difference in surface area. There's certainly a difference in weight, but there's really not that much difference here. Like, I could do the Air. So then I go over to the 13-inch MacBook Pro, and I start looking at the Escape, and then I'm, you know, boinging back and forth between the Escape and the real, quote-unquote, real MacBook Pro. Come to find out that's 3 pounds. 3.02 pounds. So it is almost exactly 1 pound heavier than my Adorable. I got to tell you, I understand that that's, you know, what, another 150% heavier than my Adorable, but it doesn't feel like it, man. It really doesn't feel like it.
You're saving 3/4 of a pound of dongles.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I couldn't believe how small and light that felt in my hand. And maybe I'm just trying to convince myself. Maybe I'm just trying to justify a purchase, Marco style, but it really felt unbelievably small and light. And the way I think I would configure it is a $2,400. So it is nearly $1,000 more than I spent on my MacBook Adorable, which again, $1,700 versus $2,400. But I think the way I would configure it is a 2.4 gigahertz Core i5, a 16 gigs of RAM, 1 terabyte hard drive. And then I would think about going up to the next CPU, which is $300 more. I would think about, and I think that's an i7, if I'm not mistaken. And I would think about going to an additional terabyte, so a total of 2 terabytes, for an additional $400 more. So if I did both of those things, it would be just over $3,000, which is more than I'd like to spend, but I'd at least consider it. But if I were to buy a new computer today, I really think I would get the 13-inch MacBook Pro because it really isn't that much heavier. And I don't think I need the ultimate in portability anymore, because if I do, that's why I have my iPad Pro, which I also really, really love.
Well, it's too bad you're forbidden from buying a new computer until they have a new keyboard, so we don't have to worry about
well,
this.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. Hearing you talk earlier, I was like, oh, John's right. I really do have to wait a little bit longer.
This is the wrong time to be buying a new laptop.
Yeah,
just,
it really is.
Just wait. Just wait.
And I'm going to say the exact same thing. Like, if your MacBook 12-inch was totally dead and you really needed a laptop very badly, then I would say, all right, you know, do what you got to do. You know, if you need one that badly.
Marco would tell you you could get a stainless steel MacBook One with cellular for like $300 on Amazon.
It's been refreshed.
It comes wrapped in styrofoam peanuts, but it's fine.
Yeah, so if you really were in a bind and you had to get something today, I agree with you. The 13-inch MacBook Pro, and I would say get the one with 4 ports. It's nicer. Like, just, yeah, agreed. you've served your time in 1 port purgatory. Like, just get the one with all the ports next. So you've earned it. That's the right move if you had to buy today. But because you don't have to buy today, you are looking at right now the ones that were updated now and the ones that are updated in May. You are looking at what are likely to be the very last butterfly keyboard laptops. Chances are the butterfly keyboard era will come to an end within the next year, possibly even faster than that. But I bet 1 year from now, in July 2020, make a calendar event, mark my words, I bet that in July 2020, there will either be zero Butterfly keyboards for sale from Apple, or it'll only be like old models they're still selling, but like all the new ones will have Scissor keyboards. That's my guess. And I think that's one of the reasons why they killed the 12-inch, because they can't do it for that one. It won't fit. But I think there's enough room in the other ones, especially if they're willing to revise them slightly or make them slightly thicker or slightly change the taper or whatever else. Like, I think there's enough room in the other ones where they probably could do it in all the other, including the 13-inch Air. But I bet a year from now, you will be able to get a range of multiple Apple laptops with Scissor keys. And if you get the very last Butterfly laptop just out of impatience or out of, you know, fanciness because it's new, as soon as the new ones come out, you know, 6 months later, you're going to regret that decision.
So I'm sorry. So state your bet one more time. So you're saying that there will be no new models with Butterfly switches?
My bet is in 1 year, the vast majority of laptops Apple sells, like model-wise, not like, you know, volume-wise, like the vast majority of models they sell, possibly all of them, but I'm not that confident of that. I think within a year that most of the models for sale will have Scissor keys.
Got it. It is NDUE.
I'm not willing to like bet any money on that. I'm not that confident in this, but it's just a feeling I have. Like, I think this is the end of the Butterfly.
This is such a weak bet. You're not even willing to say they'll all have it. You're just the vast majority.
Are you willing to bet that Apple doesn't sell an old model laptop for a long time these days? No.
You're sounding so confident. Then you're like, I think there'll be some models with new keyboards. Of course there will be models with new keyboards.
But not just the 16-inch. Like, I think it's going to be all of them, or most of them at least.
Well, you said the vast majority. So
yeah.
But there's only like four models. So that means you'd have to have like three of them.
Well, because like what they might do is like, you know, make the new MacBook Air that Ming-Chi Kuo predicted and have that be $200 more and keep this old one around at $999 for a while. Like, it could be something like that, right? So that's why I don't want to say all of them. But I think most of them a year from now will have Scissor keys.
I think maybe you could have... would you agree that they're not going to make any new computers with Butterfly keyboards, as in it's a new case design, a new form factor? Like, that's the easier bet to say. Like,
100%.
These are the last ones
definitely
that they're going to make with Butterfly keyboards.
I would even go as far as to say that the computers that they revised yesterday are the last revisions, even, that I think will have Butterfly keyboards.
You just think they might keep selling them?
Yes.
Tim Cook.
I think the Air that they slightly touched, like they're probably going to keep selling that as their cheapest computer for a while, because that's just how they do things. But I bet all revisions that will occur after yesterday will be Scissor keys.
I don't think you're wrong, but I am interested to see how this turns out.
And you're gonna so regret it if you bought the last, but not even I bought the last Butterfly keyboard. I haven't bought one since last year.
but remember that I actually do like the Butterfly keyboard. And truth be told, I have not yet had a bigger issue than something that I needed compressed air for with my Adorable in 2 years.
Hold on, didn't you have to bring your computer to your dad's like automotive power air compressor?
No. I didn't have to. It just so happened. I know what you're thinking of. It just so happened that I was at it. It happened to me, Marco.
Yeah,
it just
right.
So happened that I was at his house when I had an issue, and I was like, "Hey, do you have any compressed air?" And he just like looked at me. It was about the same look I got when I once asked a friend of mine from college if his twin sister was identical or not. But anyway, my dad just kind of looked at me and said, "Yes. Yes, I have compressed air." And so we went out to the garage just because it was easy.
I don't have compressed air. I do have this jet engine. Just put your laptop behind this.
Yeah, right. You've met my dad. That would be his style. But I've never had to have the thing serviced more seriously than me or, you know, dad taking compressed air to it. But yet I fear the thought that if I were to get another one, that I would not be so lucky. And so when, like I said, when John was talking earlier saying, how could you possibly buy a laptop right now if you don't need to? Yeah, you're right. Why would I be buying a laptop right now?
I feel like we're so close.
Yeah.
You know, it's been, like there have been multiple rumors from multiple directions that the Scissor keyboards are coming this fall or this winter. That's not that far away.
And imagine if the new Air is made with the design philosophy embodied by the iMac Pro, the Mac Mini, and the Mac Pro, and it comes out and it's got four ports on the side of it and a better CPU and a new keyboard and an SD card slot. You buy that instantly. You'd be like, thank God I didn't buy another laptop. This is finally a good MacBook Air again. You know, that's not going to have an SD card slot. But anyway, like just imagine that it has more ports. Like imagine that
I don't even think it'll have four ports, honestly.
There is some embodiment of more ports. I probably won't have more ports too, but I'm just thinking, well, this is what I'm thinking. Like again, with the design philosophy.
If they just took the existing MacBook Air and just put a freaking scissor keyboard in it, like that would be a great computer.
It's better, but like honestly, I'm done with the bargaining. It's like, okay, why don't you just make your laptops good again? All right, so they're all going to have just USB-C. Can you put more of those on? The answer is yes, you could. But don't stubbornly refuse to. Like, don't go for that minimalism. Make a MacBook Air with more than two ports. You can do it. It will work. People will like it. They'll buy it. They'll like it better than if it just had two. Or put an SD card slot. Two ports in an SD card slot or more than two ports. This is the line I'm drawing for the MacBook Air that was finished being designed a year and a half ago, which is the other problem with expecting something new to come out of Apple. We have to wait, you know. Anyway, yeah, don't buy these. They have bad keyboards.
So one other thing we do have to cover quickly is that Apple has fairly dramatically lowered their SSD prices. And so from 9-to-5 Mac, the 4-terabyte SSD of the 512 gig 15-inch MacBook Pro used to cost $2,800. Now it costs half that at $1,400.
That is the price, the amount that you add to the price of your computer.
Right, yes, exactly.
It's not the price of the computer with that. It's like, take the price of your computer that comes with an SSD of some size that is less than 4 terabytes, throw out that SSD, and then add $2,800 more dollars. And now it's half price at merely $1,400.
Yep. And I think that's actually really great. And I haven't been quite as bitter at Apple RAM and SSD pricing as I was probably 5 to 10 years ago, maybe less than 10, but a while ago. It used to be that they would absolutely gouge you on, well, at that time it was spinning disks and also RAM. But I feel like this is, to me, within the realm of, okay, yeah, you know, it's good. You have to make your money and it's convenient, blah, blah, blah. And okay, that makes sense. You know, $2,800, that does not make sense. $1,400 doesn't make sense to me, but I feel like it's at least reasonable.
You know, the reality is, this isn't just Apple. Like if you spec up a machine from anyone else who sells you, complete computers, from Dell, from HP, from Alienware, like whatever it is, whoever you're buying from, any kind of like RAM or hard drive upgrade at the time of purchase from the OEM is always more expensive than what you can go to Amazon or Newegg or whatever and buy your own for. It's always done that way. It's a profit center for them. It's that's just the business. That's the reality. So I know that SSD storage can be had way more cheaply outside of Apple than it can from Apple. SSD storage has gone through a massive price collapse over the last few months. It's awesome. You can get cheap, very, very cheap third-party SSDs now from other companies that are very big and very inexpensive compared to where they were even 1 year ago, let alone before that. So it's great to be in the market for storage. And you know what? Apple did lower these by a large amount. And yeah, they are still way more expensive than what you could buy it for on Amazon or whatever. But the fact is, like in this business, like you're never going to get that price from the OEMs, from Apple, from Dell, from HP. So the fact that they lowered the prices is great news, even though they are not the bargain basement that we always want them to be.
It just shows how out of whack they were. It's not like they reduced them by 10% or something. Like cutting the price in half and still having it be ridiculous. Like as Ben Holmes tweeted, like the prices have gone from absurd to ridiculous. Although I guess this is saying absurd is worse than ridiculous. I'm not sure I agree with it. Anyway, so this another example is on the MacBook Air with a 1 terabyte SSD. Add $400, right? And this is the thing people don't notice. Another one of the that's why I highlighted when I described the other thing. Another one of the effects of a configurator is you're like, oh, if you want the terabyte one, it's $400. Like, no, what you're doing is you're removing 512 gigabyte SSD and then you're replacing it with the 1 terabyte and you're paying $400 for that additional 512. Like, it's not like a $400 one terabyte, SSD costs $400. Like, oh, well, I can buy a 1 terabyte. You're not buying a 1 terabyte. You're buying half of a 1 terabyte because you threw away a 512, right? Their prices are still completely out of whack. Like Ben Holmes cites a price of $100 for a 1 terabyte NVMe SSD stick. I'm not sure where he's getting that price from, but yeah, like it's because you are removing an existing part or replacing it with a better part, and then looking at the price as if you're just buying the better part, not accounting for the price that you should be gaining by removing the other one. Yeah, they're like Porsche car options. They're just ridiculous and. It makes sense that's where they make their money, but if you price them too high, it like no one will ever pick that option. So honestly, Apple's probably not making as much profit as it could be to, you know, just be reasonable. And the storage, it used to be like this with memory. Now Apple is reasonable with memory. And in some respects, like it, maybe that's the better thing to do. But in other respects, if Apple doesn't eventually get its iCloud act together, either in terms of pricing or transparency or both, running out of storage on your Mac is one of the things that hurts the user experience and the satisfaction with the computer the most, because it's the thing that users are least able to deal with. And rather than motivating them to buy a new computer, it will just make them angry. Just be like, I just bought this computer 3.5 years ago, and now it's out of room, and I, as a user, have no idea what to do about that. My computer is full. They just get angry, right? And so if we could just get over, I think we're close. We're close to getting over the hump of like having enough storage. I think we're probably there on phones. Like I think most people's phones have close to enough storage now. Maybe one more doubling, and we'll probably have like enough local storage that even Apple's cloud transparency stuff is enough to paper over the difference, right? But Apple laptops specifically, especially lightweight ones, are not anywhere near getting over the hump of they have enough storage for most people, especially if you have a photo library and especially if you use iCloud photo library, even if you do the quote-unquote optimized storage, which is terrible, you can fill a default configuration Apple laptop SSD because the default configs are way too small. And the step-up configs are a lot of money, and people see even a $400 upgrade to 1 terabyte, and they think it's not worth it, and they need some nerdy computer friend like me to convince them, trust me, you will be so happy 3 years from now for that $400 you spent, because you'll still be able to use your computer as opposed to having to chuck it in the ocean because it's full, right? And there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, I've been there. Like there's a couple laptops I've owned where I just was impulsive. I just wanted to go to the Apple store and just buy one like on day one. So there wasn't time to do like a config to order option and customize the storage. And in both of those cases, that laptop ended up being a 256 gig SSD. And in both cases, that limited the useful life of the laptop severely because I just slammed into that all the time. So now these days, no matter how impatient I want to be, 512 is the minimum I will buy, and what I actually aim for a laptop is 1 terabyte.
Yeah, I feel like that's the thing that makes me like a computer the most is having it not get full. Like the 5K iMac already, like I filled the 1 terabyte SSD. I bought a big SSD. I thought I was buying a really big one back when they were really expensive. I filled it, and I had to move my entire photo library to an external SSD, which isn't the end of the world, but it kind of annoys me. And one of the things I'm looking forward to the most / fearing the most is when I get my new Mac Pro, I want it to have a lot of storage. I mean, it's less of an issue because as we discussed, you can actually put quote-unquote external drives inside the thing through various mechanisms. But I would prefer it if the super fast internal storage was big enough to, you know, hold all my stuff for 5 years without me hitting limits. So if I were to get 4 terabytes, I think that would be fine because it would be 4 times what I'm, you know, just barely able to fit in these days. So yeah, it's kind of still kind of a shame that that's where Apple gets most of its money, because, and especially on the laptops, and because most people buy laptops first of all, and second of all, like you don't have all the options of external drive and stuff because you just want to carry the laptop, and you know, if we ever talk about Catalina, we'll get into this some more, but the Mac operating system's handling of disk storage or whatever we want to call it these days. I mean, in some respects it has new features, but in other respects it's actually getting worse in terms of how confusing it is, you know, related to the weirdness of APFS. How much space do I have? How do I free up new space? How do I deal with the disk full? How does the operating system deal with the disk full? How do the applications that claim to deal with the full disk actually deal with it? It's one of the biggest pain points I've seen with Macs Less so with phones and iPads, although there was still that ad campaign from Samsung or whatever, Google or whoever it was, making fun of Apple's phones filling up with photos. But I feel like with the advent of, what is the default config on the good iPhones now? Is it 64 gigs?
I believe so, yeah. That really fixed it. Like that made it so that like we all completely stopped complaining about how like the entry level storage was so bad before. Like, you know, back when it was 16 gigs, that was terrible. And it stayed 16 gigs for a very long time. And once they went up, they first went to 32, and I think some models might still begin at 32, but for the most part, they begin at 64 now. Huge improvement, and it basically takes care of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they don't get full. They still get full, but I feel like when you have 64, there's enough time for even Apple's sort of iCloud stuff to shift your iCloud, you know, shift some of the photos off and to just have like the low-quality ones. Like Apple does need to keep up with it. It's not like 64 is enough forever. Like you have to keep, you know. Anyway, that's all we're talking about here is Apple keeping pace with the increasing size and decreasing cost of storage. And they fell way behind, embarrassingly behind even for Apple, to the point where they're cutting their prices in half. And now they're slightly less embarrassingly. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it still annoys me, but like, who besides businesses? What individual person was paying an additional $2,800 for the biggest SSD? It's only businesses. Because no individual person could probably justify that, even if they were like a freelance person or whatever, and they thought they would use this, they would like, honestly, I'll just buy an external drive, because you really need to be disconnected from the budget by a lot to pay $2,800. And then if you bought one of those yesterday and saw the price cut, that's not going to feel good. I bet you could get half of that money back from Apple.
I paid it.
Yeah, well, I mean, talking about being disconnected from the value of money.
Okay, so it's for the reasons you said when I bought the iMac Pro. I weighed that decision for a long time, and I opted to do it because ultimately, like, I was juggling a lot of weird externals with my previous iMac, because when I ordered my previous iMac, the biggest it got was 1 terabyte. Like, that was the biggest option it had. Which, and at the time I bought that, and that was expensive, not that expensive, but that was expensive at the time, like in 2014 and whenever I bought that. And so when I bought the iMac Pro, I got the 4 terabyte because it was a pain in the butt juggling all these externals, and I wanted to start, I knew this was a computer I was going to have for a while, so I wanted to start at the highest point I could start at, knowing that over time I would be happy I did. And sure enough, here I am about, what, a year and a half into this computer. And I 100% stand by that decision. And even though it just got half the price, I've still gotten a year and a half of use out of that 4 terabytes, and I'm still happy I did. Yeah, it was a ton of money, but you know, so was the rest of the computer, and I decided that was worth it.
This is the MacBook Pro we're talking about, though. Like the iMac, was it exactly the same price?
$2,800. That's why when you were saying earlier, like, no one knew what it was. I knew what it was.
Well, if you didn't buy that iMac Pro yesterday, it might feel different if you did.
That's true, yeah. But anyway, and I will, before we leave this topic, which you really should do, but before I leave this topic, I will reiterate a trick I learned that I've been extremely happy with. One of the biggest problems when you have limited storage, like almost every laptop, is the way Photos doesn't really purge the purgeable space when you have it in, like, you know, only keep small things mode. Like, if you have it, keep your whole photo library, you're on your own. But if you have, like, and that's how I do my iMac. I just have to keep everything because I have the space for it. But if you're on a computer that's like a secondary one, like your laptop or something, where you only have Apple Photos keep, like, the, you know, the small versions and, you know, offload things to the cloud, it marks the space that it uses as purgeable. But as John said, the OS doesn't deal with that the way you think it will. It doesn't provide the controls that you need. A lot of times you try to use the space that is left and it doesn't purge it, and so you can't use the space or whatever. So it's a bit of a mess. So what I did when I set up my most recent laptop last summer was I put the Photos library, which you can move where that is, I put it on a sparse disk image that has a size cap. I think I made it like 30 gigs, something like that. So a size cap of a sparse disk image, put it in login items, so the sparse disk image always mounts on login. That's where my Apple Photos library is, and it obeys the disk quota of the sparse image you put it on. So my Photos library is capped on my laptop at 30 gigs. No matter what I do, it will make space so it fits in that 30 gigs, and then I don't have to deal with it intruding on the rest of my drive. So that is by far the biggest like quality of life improvement that I've discovered for having a modern Apple laptop with limited SSD space. I highly suggest everyone do that.
It's a little bit scary. I mean, I'm not even sure that's even a supported configuration. I understand the application can't tell the difference, but I'd be a little bit scared of it. The other thing, though, is I don't know if this is still true, but I believe at one point, and maybe this was just on iOS, like the optimized storage thing, and maybe I'm doubting whether this was actually true or not, but my impression was that back in the day, what optimized storage would do is it would download lower quality, smaller, not thumbnails, but just lower quality versions of photos to save space. The problem that you could run into with that strategy is eventually, if your phone fills with the lower quality ones, there is no other strategy. Like, it wasn't as if it would purge the photos entirely and download them on demand. It always wanted to have a photo on disk, so to speak. It would just be a lower quality one. So if you have a very large library and you put it in a very small, sparse disk image, it is possible that by adding pictures and adding pictures, you may hit the limit of your disk image, and then you'd have to make a second disk image or expand it or copy your stuff over or whatever, which is not the end of the world. But all this is to say, I still don't have much faith in the photo library's ability to actually manage the space available to it. I feel like it's using very naive strategies and never goes sort of full on demand where it's like, I'll pull in images as needed and I will purge them as needed. It's more like I have strategy A, which is keep everything, and strategy B, which is keep everything, but if you run out of space, keep smaller versions of some things. And that strategy runs out of space eventually. Unlike the other one, which is just, I have a buffer to work with and I will pull in the most recently used images in that buffer and purge them as needed. And the second thing, of course, with the purgeable space, I think there's actually a way to make it purge. But the other thing that always gets people is local Time Machine backups. So, I mean, this is a nerdy thing to do, but if you are a nerdy person listening to this and you frequently have space issues or you need to free up some space that you think should be free, but some part of the operating system or application thinks it's not, and you're running a modern version of macOS, TMUTIL, and look at the local snapshot stuff. You can list your local Time Machine back snapshots, and you can delete your local Time Machine snapshots, and that will save a surprising amount of space depending on what you've updated recently on your Mac.
We are sponsored this week by Fracture, who prints your photos in vivid color directly on glass. Almost all of us take and share photos, but very few of those photos end up actually being printed, and even fewer end up on display anywhere to enjoy. So most photos we take, they get on like a social feed or something, and they're gone after, what, a day at most? You never see them again. Let Fracture help you focus on the moments that mean the most in your life by turning your favorite memories into actual physical photos. Fracture makes these amazing edge-to-edge glass prints. They print the photo directly on the surface of the glass, and it shines through, so you have like this glass front printing on the back that shines through, and then this foam core behind that to hold up like, you know, a screw or a wall anchor or anything else, which, by the way, they include in the box. So it is an amazing edge-to-edge piece of glass that is still very lightweight. You don't have to worry about it like falling off the wall or anything. And it's very, very beautiful looking in pretty much any decor because it's just glass, edge-to-edge, no borders, no frames, no bezels. So it just fits in pretty much anywhere. And I got to say, these make amazing prints and amazing gifts. We've given Fracture prints as gifts to family and friends to show off pictures of our kid to our family or help enjoy a moment that we share with friends, maybe like a photo from a vacation we went on together. It's just a wonderful service to make amazing prints out of your photos. They're even a green company operating a carbon neutral factory right here in the U.S. using U.S. source materials and all being assembled in Gainesville, Florida. So check it out today at fractureme.com/ATP for a special discount on your first Fracture order. They'll ask you where you came from and just tell them you came from ATP. So once again, fractureme.com/ATP for a special discount on your first Fracture order. Don't forget to tell them you came from ATP. Thank you so much to Fracture for making amazing photo prints on glass and for sponsoring our show.
Ron Olson would like to know, what are your opinions on naming computers? Back when I was in college and even through my first few tech jobs, whimsical names for computers were ubiquitous. In my university, they were named after 50s TV characters. But of late, it seems standard for computers to have names as interesting as a barcode. I'm curious what everyone thinks of giving more memorable names to their machines. I used to do this. I don't even remember the like schemes that I used to use, but I cannot remember the last time I have changed the name of a computer other than to maybe take my name out of it. So instead of like Casey's MacBook, it just says MacBook or something like that. I don't even, and I'm not even sure I did that much. So I haven't done this in forever and a day, and I rarely pay attention to this sort of thing. John, what do you think about this?
You said this is going to be quick. I could go for 20 minutes and just on naming
computers.
I could just do one question. So in thinking about this, I'm not going to say I've always named my computers, because before the internet and before ubiquitous networking, there was not much reason to have a sort of computer world manifestation of what you call your computer, because it wasn't addressable by its name to other computer things. And for me, at least, I never named my computer in the same way that like you'd name your car, right? Like there's no reason for your car to have a name. Other people don't have like, you know, Apple's glasses on, and they might look at your car, they see your car's name. Like there's no sort of computerized reason for it to have a name. If you give your car a name, it's just because you want to give it a name. So what I would do with all of my Macs, though, is I would name the hard drives. The hard drive singular or the hard drives plural. Always my hard drives have, you know, the Apple hard drives would come and it's called Macintosh HD. I think still to this day it says Macintosh, a whole spelled out space, capital H, capital D, even though they're not really hard drives anymore. I would rename the hard drive. And that was basically like the computer name, especially when you just had one hard drive. It was your boot hard drive. It was inside the computer. But I wasn't technically naming the computer. I was naming the hard drive, because if I had a second hard drive, it would have a different name. So I've always done that. Usually it's like cartoon characters, and I would have a matching icon and all this other stuff. Like, I continue to do that to this day. But in the modern era, when your computers are networked, even if it was just Apple Talk, and nowadays like the, you know, Rendezvous or whatever the hell it's called, ZeroConf networking and everything, there are reasons to give your computer a name that you can address it with. So all the computers in my house, both their boot hard drive and their name of the computer is whatever icon and name their boot hard drive gets. So again, use, you know, video game characters and other all various other things. So yeah, the only thing I've done recently is, as I've gotten lots of computers, I got tired of coming up with new names. So I basically give my computer the same name all the time. It just, you know, I don't give it Roman numerals. It doesn't become the second or third. It just takes on the mantle of that name.
Yeah, it's like Air Force One. It's like whatever's your current computer has that name.
Yeah, more or less. And I do the same thing with my work computer across many different work computers and many different jobs. I always give my work computer similar names, so I don't have to keep thinking of new names. And then the only other interesting story I have about this is like the naming of the computer and not the hard drive or whatever began far, you know, before I ever got into it, in the world of servers that needed to have names, you know, the internet, DNS, all that other stuff, right? And at universities where you'd have labs full of computers that weren't, in the very old days, they weren't PCs or Macs, they were Unix machines. They were on the internet via TCP/IP and had host names, right? And so there was the challenge, how do you come up with host names for all these computers? And you could have boring host names, or you just call them, you know, lab one, lab two, lab three, your computer lab with all these things, you know, lab3.myschool.edu or whatever. That's very boring. And I'm sure I've told the story in ATP before, but people don't listen to the whole back catalog. So I will just reiterate, my favorite naming scheme I ever saw was in the computer graphics lab at Boston University. Whatever system it came up with this one, I thought it was very clever and interesting. The names of the machines were like Scrutable, Stinked, I'm giving it away by the way I pronounced them, like Pendant, lots of things that you'd look at them and you think they were, as like Pendant, is that misspelled? Do they mean like a thing that dangles around your neck? Scrutable, do they mean inscrutable? Or no, scribable, do they mean like able to be scribed or whatever? Anyway, it was like a lab full of machines like this, and they were all Silicon Graphics indie machines. So it was all words that began with indie, independent, indescribable. yeah, I don't remember all the names, but you would think you couldn't come up with all the words that begin with the sound indie, but they came up with like 12 of them. And I thought it was very clever, because if you looked at the names, it made no sense until you saw the pattern. So kudos to the computer graphics lab at BU, whoever came up with that naming scheme. And yes, Silicon Graphics, that was a modern thing when I was at school. When they did that Jurassic Park thing where, like, she says, this is a Unix system, I know this, and they have that weird thing where you're flying through all the buttons. That was a real thing on SGI machines. And when I saw the movie, I'm like, I do know that. That's a real thing.
That was real? That wasn't just movie.
Yeah,
BS?
It was like a demo. It was like a demo thing. I don't think they expected people to use it, but yeah, it came with SGIs. It was like a way to navigate the file system through a bunch of weird rotating sort of rectangular solid things. They didn't, you know, they didn't write the code for that, for the thing. You could buy an SGI for $20,000 in 1990, whatever, and it would come with that.
Marco, any thoughts?
Not really. I have a similar Air Force One situation where I named my computer forever ago, and just whenever I get a new one, it just inherits the old name. With one notable exception to relevant to our conversation earlier, when I got the MacBook Escape, I named it Escape. And then when I later got the 15-inch touch bar to replace it, well, I lost my escape key. So I called it No Escape, which was kind of a play on, you know, not only losing my escape key, but that now I have no escape from these horrible butterfly keyboards. You're stuck with them forever. So my laptop became known as No Escape, and my laptop is still, to this day, even though it's now two laptops later, called No Escape.
Only two? Are you sure you didn't drop a zero there? All right. Pedro Estarque writes, Hi, I'd love to hear John's take on the recent default shell change from Bash to ZSH in Catalina for new installs. Given license issues with Bash, why not Fish, since the guy works at Apple and GPL version 2 seems uncontroversial? So I'm not 100% sure that's correct about the creator of Fish working at Apple, but I think that's correct. But either way, John, how do you feel about Bash to ZSH? Because you usually use ZSH, don't you? Or did I make that up?
You are misremembering. Okay. So we actually have a whole section about Catalina that if we ever get to, we probably will at some point when we have to do like three episodes a week to deal with vacations in the summer. Anyway, yeah, this is one a minor point in it that some of the Unix stuff in Catalina is changing. So we'll talk about the rest of it later. But for now, for the shell stuff, what I heard is that it was a license issue. I don't know if that's actually true. It's hard to get this type of answer from Apple because you can, if you're lucky, Apple will tell you what they're doing, but they rarely tell you why, especially for something like this. I don't use Bash or ZSH, so this doesn't affect me. I use TCSH for legacy reasons because it's what the Unix system at my university used, and that's just what I got used to. I do not recommend it. Fish, I believe the person who writes Fish does or did work at Apple when he wrote Fish. I'm not sure if he still does work at Apple. Apple should not change their default shell to Fish because Fish is a weird shell. If Apple is not in a position to make something the de facto shell for Unix computers, like by shipping it, that it's not like that everyone will follow them. If the whole rest of like the Linux world essentially switched to Fish, then yes, by all means, Apple should start shipping Fish. But if Apple is the only one doing it, they shouldn't, because then Apple's Unix will get the reputation of like, oh, Apple's got Unix, but it's got this weird shell. And it's like, only Unix nerds know. You can change your shell, right? But it won't matter. It'll just be like Apple, the Macs have Unix, but the shell is weird. Right, by going with Bash, because it's what everybody else uses, Apple does not have a weird shell. ZSH is less weird than Fish. It is closer, more closely aligned to Bash. It has been around for much longer. It is less weird. So if you have to change from Bash to something, ZSH is a reasonable alternative. I don't care because I don't use either one of the shells.
Fair enough. Marco, do you have any thoughts on this?
I do care quite a bit because I use Bash heavily in my Mac usage. I have shell scripts that use it. I use it directly on the, you know, in terminal a lot. So I do care, but I don't yet know enough about ZSH to know like how much of my stuff is this going to break or require relearning.
Well, you don't have to use it. You can just use Bash. Like you can either build your own Bash and install it, and I think they'll still ship Bash. It's just changing the default shell.
That's a pain in the butt, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, look, I have used the non-default shell for basically the entire life of Mac OS X. It preserves it across installs, so it's not like a thing you need to do. It's just when you set up a brand new computer, if you don't do a migration assistant or whatever install, type CHSH and you'll be off to the races. It's just fine.
Oh, all right.
For what it's worth, I've used Fish for years, and I do not use very many shell scripts. I've not written very many shell scripts. So I'm just using it for just navigating around and doing basic operations. And I love it. I don't argue that it is very weird, though. Finally, Tyler Menard writes, how do you use and take care of your big camera at the beach? Carefully. I don't really have any particularly good answers here. I try to put it in like whatever backpack or bag or what have you that I brought it to the beach in when I'm not actively using it. I also don't go like deep into the surf like John does with his big camera. But generally speaking, just being careful and trying to keep it away from anything that can hurt it, which, yes, I recognize every grain of sand on that entire beach can hurt it, but just doing my best to, you know, put it inside a towel or put it in a backpack, like I said, and just keeping it as far away from sand as I possibly can. Marco, you occasionally live outside of the beach, but generally live on the beach. What do you do with this?
I don't bring my big camera to the beach almost ever, and so I kind of avoid the issue.
Fair enough. John?
So I'm on now a 15-year run of bringing quote-unquote big cameras to the beach and haven't lost one yet, which means that I'm well overdue to drop my camera in the ocean this summer. I know it's going to happen eventually. My plan is basically I have a separate bag that's just for the camera that I try to keep away from children because children kick sand everywhere. Like, you have to just keep a perimeter, right? And the camera is either around my neck or it's in that bag. It's a fact of life. It gets sand and salt spray on it. I clean it between trips, try to get the sand and salt spray off. The bottom line is some tiny, minuscule speck of salt water is going to get inside your camera and it's going to slowly corrode some electrode and then, or some solder joint or something, or the contacts on the SD card, or like, there's no stopping it. Like, and my cameras that I've had are not particularly weatherproof, but even if you get a quote unquote weatherproof one, unless it's in one of those things that you use to take your camera, you know, deep sea diving, in the beach versus camera, beach wins. So just be resigned to the fact that by taking your big fancy camera to the beach frequently, you are killing your camera and eventually it will die. And as long as you can be okay with that and get good pictures in the meantime, fine. But there is no real strategy other than be careful and take as much care that you can. That will stop eventually the salt water from winning. The ocean always wins.
I would even go as far as to say like that applies to pretty much everything that you bring near the ocean. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a highly corrosive environment. It's full of salty air and moisture and gritty sand and like all the like everything about going near the ocean is amazing for your mind and terrible for anything physical. So just, you know, anything that is going to be near or on a beach, you are limiting its lifespan, and that's just part of the deal. Anyway, thanks to our sponsors this week, Linode, Fracture, and Boosted Boards, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. 'Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. 'Cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse, it's accidental.
Tabs I have open in Safari right now?
I do not. I
three.
Do. What? Are you feeling okay? It's Chrome. That's the issue, isn't it?
I close them when I'm done, and I haven't been doing any major web browsing. Here's the thing. This computer is getting far less use as it gets old. Right? I use it for podcasting now, and then during the day, if I need to do something on the computer, I use the iMac. So.
Oh, man.
Everything here has been closed except for like the tabs that I always leave open, you know, like Gmail and stats pages.
I just assume when you said three that it was like one of those charts that you see, and at the bottom it says like millions.
just three. One window, three tabs. Chrome is one window, one, two, three, four tabs. Five tabs, sorry.
Man. times are changing.
I know.
No, it's not. If I go to the other computer, that is not true. If you go to my work computer, very not true. It's just because I'm not using this one. I would use it and close out the tabs, and I would never open new ones. Like the biggest source of new tabs is like, you know, shopping research. What am I trying to do? My dog's even eating the coasters, so we're trying to find new coasters. That's a lot of tabs. I need to find like a dog-proof coaster. It has to be acceptable to me, but also not attractive for the dog.
I've never had to solve that particular problem before. My dog is too low to reach coasters.
Now, I know it's tricky. Like, you know, you just get ones like a lot of ones that are not attractive for the dog are unacceptable to me. Like you get stone coasters, but I don't like that. I don't like the feeling of putting a glass on stone. The ones that we have, which we got again, got when we were married. We have a lot of things that we got when we were married that had lasted until the kids and our pets destroyed them. These have cork on them. Like you put the glass on cork, and I love that feeling. Like the glass of a glass of water on a little cork coaster.
That is a nice feeling.
But the dog likes wood. So what I want is like something that's like stone or metal with a cork insert for the glass, but it like has a rim around it. Cause you also need like the condensation not to leak out onto the thing. So it has to be slightly cup, you know, there has to be an indentation, and in the indentation I want cork, but I want the material to be totally non-dog attractive. Like a dog's not going to bite on a metal or stone thing. So I'm still working on it. Anyway, a lot of tabs.
There are a lot of advantages to having a low dog.
Low dog that doesn't want to chew. My dog wants to chew. She's good. She doesn't chew most things, but and she's got a lot of her own chew toys. But every once in a while, she'll be like, coaster.